Hello and welcome to the October edition of Tech IE. Tech IE is a radio program put on by the New Hampshire section of the IEEE. The IEEE, also known as the Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers, is a worldwide organization of professional engineers in all disciplines. IEEE, advancing humanity through technology. My name is Ed Nelson. I'll be your host this month. Our topics this month are going to be gamification and the Internet of Things. This month, joining me in the studio is Kat Regan.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
So you decided to join us again, huh?
Yeah, it was fun the last time. I'm sure it's going to be fun today.
So tell us, our listeners, a little bit about yourself.
I've been in IEEE for about 4 years, and it's been a great experience. And I've worked for BAE Systems for almost 10 years now. I'm a software engineer, and I graduated from University of Amherst.
Great.
University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Oh, okay. I have two special guests this month. I've got James McKim with me. How you doing, Jim?
Hi, Ed. Thank you.
James, can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I've been a IEEE member for a number of years. I started my career as a programmer analyst, doing programming of various commercial systems. And these days, I spend my time as a learning program manager at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, where I develop global learning programs for our 300,000 employees around the world.
And also joining this month is Stephanie Collins, a professor at Southern New Hampshire University. How you doing, Stephanie?
Well, thank you.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been an IEEE member since graduate school. And it's a long time ago, so I won't go into all that. But I'm currently a professor of computer information technology at Southern New Hampshire University. My particular area of interest is computer networks. I like to talk about the Internet of Things because obviously that's in the network world.
Well, thank you for joining us this month. Well, our first topic this month is going to be gamification. James, I understand that you've got some awards in the area of gamification. So if you would lead off our discussion of gamification by describing gamification for our listeners.
I think what we can start off with is that there are a few concepts that make something a game. And the National Research Council has identified that games usually have an affordance and a constraint. And the way that that manifests itself is that a game usually has rules of engagement, it has goals for the players to pursue, and it has some means of displaying progress against achieving those goals. If you take those three concepts along with the concepts of affordance and constraints, you have the makings of a game. And what we try to do with games is to apply some behavior, some activity apply those concepts to some kind of activity that we want to have the players or someone achieve.
Gotcha. So with a term like gamification, it's basically we're taking a task or, well, I guess at any kind of task, and turning it into something more fun, a game.
That's the idea behind a game. As we growing up, we played games, and there was usually some kind of goal that we were trying to achieve, and there was some kind of reward attached to it as well.
Right. Yeah. So I'm assuming that by making it into a game and making the rewards visible to the player, the person who's using the software, that it makes it more fun as well.
That's right. It's software, and it started off as just software, but it grew to be hardware as well. We now have the consoles, the gaming consoles that are the interface to the computer that either plays against you or enhances your play or provides the environment for the play, or even connects you. And bringing Stephanie in with networks, connecting you with other people. So what you're playing is a game, which you might be playing on your computer with the computer in front of you, but you could be playing with somebody or multiple people who are thousands of miles away from you. So that's also bringing that that kind of technology in, to bear in creating a fun environment and fun thing to
right.
do.
Right. And gamification can apply to learning.
Absolutely. And that's what I've actually won some awards around from, for example, an organization called Brandon Hall, which is a consulting firm mostly, but they keep track of learning and learning technologies. So what we did is we actually built, and I ran a project that was a $1.2 million project to basically gamify how we take our employees through a year's worth of getting trained to do the work that they need to do on a day-to-day basis. So we built this environment where we had a list of the courses that they needed to take, and we figured out how to make those courses commensurate with the skills that they needed to learn. And as they learn those skills, they reach certain levels, and that we gave them certain goals to reach certain levels at different times during the year. And we built a leaderboard for them to be able to see both their progress as well as the progress of the other employees who are doing their same job. So it gives you a sense of competition as well as a fun way to see your progress and right. To go through the learning.
Right. So there's like a social component to it
there's
as well.
Absolutely a social component. And we built a nice board which you could see other people and how they were progressing along their path for learning what they needed to learn.
So when, as they gained these levels, what was the game part of it?
So,
as
they gain these levels, they get to see their progress on the board, and that makes it a little fun.
Yeah.
But they're also, through their management structure, rewarded for achieving certain levels of knowledge and skills. Not to mention that these were salespeople. So as they learned more, they actually were able to make more money because they were able to sell better and sell more.
Oh, that's cool.
So we're integrating not just the reward of the game, but the reward of the real work along with that. So, and I can also say this has been an evolution of gaming. I mean, gaming kind of started in the, I'd say, the consumer space back in the early 80s. And you can think of games like Carmen Sandiego and Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing. Those are some of the early games that were built using the early PCs. and they were pretty much simply using the keyboard. And the computer knew how to translate what you did on the keyboard. And it wasn't always just typing the keys. I remember my son having a program, and I forget the name of it, but it was learning piano.
Oh, wow.
Using a PC. So he had this overlay that went over the keys that was a piano keyboard. And as you press the keys on the piano keyboard, it pressed certain keys. And the computer system knew which music keys you were punching. And it could guide you along to learn songs. So that's the kind of computer program that kind of started the genre on PCs in the consumer space. And it's evolved in there to providing more platforms. We get the Xbox. We get the other gaming platforms and games like Civilization. And that evolved into, in the mid-90s, the virtual worlds that we now have, where you can create an avatar, which is a representation of yourself inside a computer game. And with these virtual worlds, you use the keyboard or your mouse to move yourself around in these virtual worlds. So you can think of the games like Tag that we used to play as kids. Think of your avatar playing those in your computer, not just with your friends who are physically locally around you, but with someone who's anywhere around the world. So very powerful use of the technology that is applied to games and our business in learning development try to apply that to learning. So we have learning situations and simulations where we might create a sales situation where we have several avatars in a virtual world, and your job as a participant in the game is to sell your product or service to the people in that virtual world. So simulation is what's available through that. And we're evolving now to use virtual reality as well as just virtual world. So that with the headsets, the optical and whatnot, we're immersing our players into a world where we're not just being an avatar in the world, but they're actually seeing what's in the world, the computer-generated world. And that makes us even more, as players, it brings deeper learning. And there's a whole world of neuroscience and brain science that comes into this as well.
Right.
Lots of research has been done about how our senses, the more our senses are immersed into a situation, the more we learn, the more our behavior will be transformed by the experience. So we're going from just basic computer programs that you can play with your keyboard and see on your screen to Pong balls going back and forth to being truly immersed in a digital world. And basically people can live in those digital worlds.
Yeah. So how is the game? Is it the immersion in the virtual world that causes the deeper learning, or is it the gamification that causes the deeper learning?
Great question. It's a combination of the two. And from neuroscience, what we understand is the more that you can fire neurons by activating more of your senses, the deeper and longer the learning. So if you think about the world of virtual reality and controlling an avatar, you're exposing more of your senses to the world in which you're trying to operate. When you put your virtual headset on, you're exposing even more of your senses to that virtual world. So the more firing of neurons that you can have happen during your experience, the deeper your learning and the longer your learning is going to be.
And by deeper learning, we mean you absorb more of the material, you understand it better. Is that what we mean by deeper learning?
Absolutely. All of the above. It's a matter of not just being able to use different ways of remembering things, but remembering them longer and understanding the intricacies and the integration between various concepts. The more the neurons fire, they're bringing emotions into play, which is what playing really does. It brings emotion into the world, not just your mental cognitive abilities.
So I read online that gamification can also be used to increase loyalty in consumers. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. So this goes back to the neuroscience we were just talking about. The more you're engaged in a fun activity, the more you remember that activity and you remember the situation in which that activity was created. And if a company is who's creating that activity and providing that experience for you, you are going to better remember that company and want to do things that company is providing you as an opportunity to do or buy things from that company because it's imprinted in your brain that this is a great company. I had so much fun doing whatever it is you were doing with that company that you want to do whatever you can with that company.
Do you have any examples of like a company that didn't apply these gamification, converting or retrofitting their product to apply that and having a lot of success?
I think what we're seeing in industry is where companies that are online are having the most success doing this. And if you think about Amazon as one of those companies that's been on the bleeding edge, if you want to call it that, of use of technology, think about how Amazon remembers what you've done and makes recommendations about what you've done in the past.
Is that considered gamification?
Well, it can be if you think of Amazon's keeping kind of a scoreboard for you. If you look at your order history, that's a scoreboard. That's what you've purchased. It's your kind of your chit, if you will.
Right.
For achieving a goal of paying for something you wanted. So they're incorporating the experience of that scoreboard, and buying is by many people thought of as a competitive sport.
Are they going to have leaderboards soon that people can see?
Well, think about when they say others have bought this product.
Right.
That's almost a leaderboard.
Yeah.
because you're seeing what other people have bought. Now, it doesn't say that 500 other people have bought it, which is more of the gamification, the gaming aspect of a leaderboard. But it said a number of people have bought it, which means it's more than one, more than likely.
Yeah. And then making buying fun. I mean, eBay does it with their auctions. I mean, I remember the first couple times I got on eBay and I'm like, yes, I won the auction. It's like, okay, I paid twice as much as I needed to, but I won the auction.
It's that it's that competition. Most of us, I'll say, have it. Not everybody is driven to competition, but most of us are driven to competition, and that's fun for us.
Yeah.
Oh, like how they have in Amazon the reviews, and they show how many likes you have, and then they say the most helpful, most useful, and they give quantifiers to those reviews.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Wouldn't you like to make the most useful review?
I have to say I wasted so much time on Reddit just because I wanted karma.
Have you thought about the addictive aspect of games? I know that we all have played various kinds of games, and sometimes we've played them a lot longer than we wanted to. I know I've sat down and played some games, and I thought, oh, is it 4 a.m. already?
Well, I can speak from personal experience because, and as many parents will attest, our kids are prone to just sit on the computer hour after hour after hour and not go outside and play. That is absolutely something that I've thought about and the industry is really concerned about. And it reminds me of the fact that when we become parents, we don't come with a parenting book. We kind of have to learn the boundaries and how to impose those boundaries in a positive way. So just how much time is allowed for being on the computer playing a game? Well, how much time is allowed for watching television? It's going to vary, and you have to work out what that best amount of time is for that child. But you do want to make sure that you're helping your child to become well-rounded. And maybe it's 5 hours of game today, like World of Warcraft, which my son needs to do, but no time, or maybe it's 10 minutes the next day. And it's a balancing act that you as a parent and we as a society have to make sure that we're implementing. Otherwise, we are going to end up with a society of kids and adults as they grow who are
incredibly addicted,
don't want to do nothing but sit on their computer and play games. Maybe it's with somebody else. And this to me also gets into the realm of people seem to see technology as always bad, as in we want to get people off of technology because, oh, they're texting means they're not gaining any social skills. Well, you know what? It's just a different way of getting at social skills, because what are they doing? They're talking to other people through the technology. It's not as if they're not interacting with someone. It's just that they're not doing it face-to-face. There's a balancing act there, I think, of letting them use the technology, but also they do need to get out and be face-to-face with people to learn how to do that kind of social skill.
To bring this back to gamification, one could argue that Pokemon Go has made being outdoors a game.
Yes, indeed.
And we did a radio show on Pokemon Go in August, and which was aired in September for all you listeners.
It was a good show. Jim, you said that the industry is concerned about the social implications of the addictive nature of gamification.
Right.
As companies want people to use their software. Companies want to have people frequently use it and use it for longer. What has the industry done to kind of offset that? And what is their reasoning or purpose or benefit to having kids or people use their software less and not abusing it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I would say the industry isn't doing much about that, because remember what industry is. Industry is wanting to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not spending energy defining time periods or time limits on use of their technology. Now, the more forward-thinking companies are working with research firms to try to understand what limits can be, but they're not yet building any of that into their products. And that's why it becomes even more important for us as adults and of parents who might be using the games to put some kinds of limits and some controls around the use of those games. And it gets really hard when the game is actually a way of learning.
Yeah,
it's something you want the kids that, and your children or whoever to do because they're learning in the process. So this is where there takes an understanding of not just how to use the technology, but about how people learn and how to balance that learning of one subject with learning around the rest of life. Really interesting question. And the corollary to this is concern about violence that kids are seeing through these shoot 'em up games. And how is that impacting kids as they grow up? Is that changing their behavior, making it more acceptable to be violent and acceptable to see violence and not do something to stop that violence? There's lots of research going on right now, and there's a debate. There's a debate as to whether the violent games really are influencing kids to be more violent, or whether it's just whether they can compartmentalize it. And I think what you'll hear the psychologists who are dealing with young kids saying is they don't know how yet to separate what they see on a computer versus real life. Older kids who have a little more experience may, but younger kids are not so sure. So it's a real debate going on in the industry right now.
Well, this debate is similar to what I've heard about when I was growing up. It was cartoons, all the violence we saw in the cartoons. So I think it's whatever the new technology is, there's got to be something bad about it.
I think though with games, one of the things about cartoons is you were the passive watcher.
True.
If you're playing a game and you're the one that's controlling that shooter that is mowing down all these characters in the game, that's not passive anymore. Mm-hmm. Now you're the shooter. And, I mean, that's what we call those games, first-person shooters.
True.
So I think that's just a difference in approach. I'm not necessarily saying that all games are bad or anything like that, but you have to understand that if you're going to teach a child to be immune to the effects of violence, oh, it's only a character, pretty realistic character, falls down and bleeds or gets blown up into little pieces. How far removed is that from a real person being shot down, lying down and bleeding or being blown into pieces? You become blasé about it, and I don't know how blasé people get, but
I think
I'd be worried.
I think with games, there's a lot of games where they involve a storyline and they do try to teach the social context between the shooter games and what happens to people and make you actually feel for the people and the characters in the game too. So even though there might be violence in the games, there's also a storyline to kind of like give perspective of what that means in the context of, well, in the game itself, but maybe even in the real world.
I think there are some games that do that, and there are other games that don't.
Of course.
And that's the challenge. For the games that don't, they are, as Stephanie said, creating an environment where they are interacting with that violence. They're causing that violence. And that's a very different thing than just sitting back passively and watching the violence happening on screen.
Well, I was a young kid when Mortal Kombat came out, like a long time ago. And like, at least for me and for my peers who we can understand reality versus fantasy, like that violence is more entertainment. And we know that it's entertainment and it doesn't have any like impact to our lives. At least that's what I've experienced.
Yeah.
And not to say that I know what the research says.
Well, let me ask this question. I mean, if we're concerned about games being violent, do we have to worry about gamification being violent?
I think not. And I think it all boils down to what's the purpose of the game, what's the environment in which the game is, and what's the activity that you're trying to either teach someone or have it be fun to do.
Right.
So you can gamify tag. Is tag a violent game? No.
Well, maybe
the way you played it was.
I could hit you really hard.
Have you heard of Stormfront?
No.
I briefly read it. I was reading it on Wikipedia, and they said that the people are actually worried that terrorists might use gamification to teach people how to become, I guess, more violent. And one example was Stormfront. I didn't read it, but I was hoping to hear if you knew what it was.
I don't know what it is, but I can absolutely see how you can use gamification to teach anybody anything. You can make it fun. You can make anything fun if you spend enough time to think through what are the goals, what are the rules of engagement, and how do you show someone their progress in the game. That taps into your competitive nature, and absolutely, you can do that.
I don't want to go without mentioning. I mean, while I was doing some research, I happened to find out that there were a couple of personal productivity apps that mm-hmm. gamify the hated to-do list. And I don't know if any of you have come across any of these apps or what your thoughts are on them. Or
I have quite a bit of apps that are gamified. Being Fitocracy is an application mm-hmm. that you use to work out. So you set up a profile, you write down you tell the application what type of weights you're lifting, at what how heavy it is, and you level up, you gain experience, you get titles, and they also give you points. So the more weight that you use and the harder the actual activity that you're doing, the more points you'll get. I also have a Fitbit, and you can pair up with your friends to do challenges. So you can get all your friends to say, let's see who can walk the farthest mm-hmm. in a particular day or in a week. And whoever wins.
The health and wellness world is just booming with use of Fitbits and that technology. And it's being driven somewhat by the corporate world, who's realized that it's cheaper to keep someone well than it is to deal with them once they've gotten sick. So they're just embracing these technologies. At Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, we have a wellness program where we get little pedometers. Yeah. And we have a wellness game that people around the globe are competing in to keep ourselves well. So it's a huge, huge industry.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it does take a lot less to keep somebody healthy than it does to fix somebody once they're sick.
Right.
Ed, you said that you downloaded a couple games that were gamified. Do you know what they were and what they were for?
Apps.
Well, I looked at a couple apps, but I haven't downloaded any yet. But it occurs to me as we're talking, there was years ago when I was much 40 pounds heavier and I didn't like working out, I went to the YMCA and they had this stationary bike and you could like pedal, and you could be you could watch a pace rider in right. front of you right. or you would try to pass them. But my favorite was this thing about being in some sort of pseudo-oriental world where you were pedaling your chariot and you had to collect dragons. And so you had to, like, to get a silver dragon, you had to get like a silver ball, and then you had so many seconds to go get a silver dragon. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the higher value dragons were farther away and up steeper hills than the easier dragons. And that really got me exercising. So that was a gamification of just exercise. And like I said, that was 40 pounds ago. So
and it the beauty of that is it's engaging your brain to do something more than just move your muscles.
Right.
And that's what makes it fun.
Yeah.
I was going to say, and this is how Ed learned how to ride a bike.
Well, it's how Ed learned how to exercise and keep himself healthy. Okay. We're running out of time. Stephanie, do you have something
well,
like that?
I guess we can segue over to the Internet of Things, because you mentioned your Fitbit, which is one of the things in the Internet of Things. So for those people who don't know what the Internet of Things is, it's the collection of objects that are all connected to the Internet and therefore to each other. So it's your Fitbit, your smartwatch, maybe your game console. If you have a smart TV, it is one of the things. Lots of us are now buying smart devices. And what that means is that these devices are actually connected to the internet in some fashion. So they all, and they fall into different classes of things. One class is things that simply record what's happening. Others that try to control something that's happening. So for example, if you have a smart thermostat, you can be in your office and set your thermostat at home to be whatever temperature you want to be in your home. Sounds great, you know. So on a cold winter day when your house has been chilly all day long because you haven't been there, and you decide, well, I'm going to go home in half an hour, so I'm going to get the house warmed up, so by the time I get there, it'll be nice and cozy. Great. You know, you can control from far away. Or if you have a smart doorbell, you're not home, but somebody rings your doorbell is actually viewing the individual who is pushing the bell and trying to get entrance to your home. So you can see that on your computer at work or a tablet or whatever device you have. And it's all connected. So we have these devices that observe, devices that control, and devices that do both those things. And those are devices that are very useful. And increasingly, more and more devices are being developed that can do these things. So some of us are wearing medical devices. There are devices that monitor various health status statistics, something that monitors your heartbeat or your blood pressure or maybe even your blood sugar or some other things. And the goal eventually for many of these devices is to be able to intervene so that if you have, for example, an implanted defibrillator and it senses that your heart is starting to go into arrhythmia, gives you a little shock and resets your heartbeat. Great. Doesn't mean you get rushed off to the hospital because of this arrhythmia. And of course, it communicates with the hospital or doctor, and they know that this has happened to you without them actually seeing you, which is, again, an advance. And it is certainly kind of a safety blanket for people who might have health issues or any other thing. So we need to think about all these Internet of Things, that smart refrigerator that tells you you're out of eggs.
Mm.
Right. Or even intervenes and orders eggs from the delivery service so that eggs arrive at your door and you don't even have to do much about it, or whatever else you have in your refrigerator.
Yeah, Amazon has a product now. They're like these little buttons you can press that when you run out of something, you press it and they will automatically order whatever button you press.
So this is a tremendous, I don't want to call everything an advance, but it's a tremendous use of technology in ways that we never thought about in the past. Part of it has been driven by the fact that everything can be miniaturized. Cameras can be very tiny, so they can be implanted in or installed in various devices, and we can watch everything in the world. You can put a bracelet on your child's wrist, and that's GPS enabled, and now you know where your child is every minute of every day. And if you have a camera mounted on that bracelet, you can see the environment around your child every minute of every day. There are little there are clothes that you can put on your baby that will monitor its breathing and heartbeat. So even through the night, so you can monitor whether your baby's sleeping normally or if your baby's having some sort of problem sleeping. People who are worried about sudden infant death or any kind of issues with, you know, babies having trouble during the night, the baby's onesie tells you what's going on. So not only can you watch your baby, but you actually have sensors on the baby's body to see what's going on. So, you know, for some things, it gives people peace of mind. So those are the good things. Of course, there's a downside.
Okay, Stephanie, let me interrupt you for a second. There's a couple things I wanted to cover in the mid-break that I forgot to. I would just like to point out that if you're listening to our radio show and you like what you're hearing, you might want to consider becoming an IEEE member. If you go to our website, IEEE-NH.org, you can learn more about our section and how to get involved. Stephanie, let's get back to the Internet of Things. I think you were talked about all the wonderful things that Internet of Things can do for us, allow us to monitor babies, monitor our hearts, know what our house is doing, tell our house to heat itself up when we're away. What was the next part you were going to mention?
Well, obviously, as I said, the things that are on the Internet of Things consists of things that collect data, things that control other devices and control the environment, and, of course, things that communicate with each other. So there are all sorts of things in most people's homes today that the devices can communicate with each other very easily. So, you know, you walk in through the door, maybe your door communicates with something else in your house. Turn on the lights so you don't have to go find the light switch or whatever, or many other things that you normally think about doing for yourself, your house can do for you. So you may have read about smart homes, all these devices that are going to do all this stuff for you automatically. That's the upside, as I said. There's a downside. A lot of these things are collecting data, and they're collecting data about you. So I know what time you went to bed last night. I know how long you slept. I know if you slept alone or didn't sleep alone, or I know that you had a cold last week. Well, some of the stuff, who cares?
Well, you're starting to sound like Santa Claus.
Well.
Or Big Brother.
Well, I think that's more the worry that people have, is that there is this big brother aspect of it, that a lot of this data is being collected, and companies are collecting this data because they want to monetize the data, which means they want to turn it into profits for themselves. So if you have trouble falling asleep and there's a pattern of having trouble falling asleep because that smartwatch has collected that data that you've been restless in the night, you may find yourself being targeted for advertisements for sleep medications or devices to help you sleep or what.
Or meditation classes.
Well, that too. So anything that, you know, if I think that I can make some money off of that, I'm going to try to sell you what I think you need. So there's a lot of information that's being collected, and it's being stored in the cloud. We all know about the cloud, and you may not know that it's out there, but there it is. So everyone has a profile. So that can, you know, for some people, that's a real uncomfortable thought.
There are laws out there that's supposed to protect personal identifying information, PII. I was just kind of curious if I'm curious, do you know what laws are out there to protect, and are the laws working, or are they failing, or are companies just completely ignoring these laws?
I don't think that they're necessarily ignoring those laws. I think that companies, responsible companies, you know, like your hospital is not going to disclose information about you because of the HIPAA law.
Yeah.
Others who have a fiduciary duty, your bank will not deliberately disclose information about you. But you have all these sensors all over your house. And these sensors are saying, well, your pattern is you come into the house, the first place you head is the kitchen, you dump all the stuff on the table, and you pour yourself a big slug of scotch.
Oh.
All right. Whose responsibility is it to safeguard that information?
But there are examples where, for example, AOL, they were recording the searches. It was either Yahoo or AOL or some company was recording searches, and they stripped out the actual personal information being person's name who is doing the searches and put a identifier to those searches. And it turns out when you mash the data together, people could figure out who was who. And as a result, these companies were, that company was sued.
Well, again, that happens after the fact. In the meantime, that information is there. It's been stored. It's been used. If you use Gmail, for example, do this at home because it doesn't hurt anything. Write an email to your friend and say, mention purple socks, completely out of context with everything else in your email. Gmail trolls your email to see what you're talking about. You're going to start seeing ads for purple socks. And that happens with all of these free services. You know, that old saying, if the service is free, you are the product. That's what they're selling, is information about you.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting point that you're trying to raise, Kat, and it's around who has access to what information. And basically the way things go is if you have established a relationship with an organization or with an entity that's collecting data on you.
Yes.
That organization is supposed to give you the opportunity to opt out of any communications with them, as well as to indicate how protected you want your data to be with them, whether you want them to share information with third-party organizations that the organization may work with. So what Stephanie is saying is we all need to be very careful about the organizations with which we interact, like Gmail, and make sure we've indicated how much we want them to share or not share any information that they collect about us. And with those free, fee-for-free or service-for-free companies, it's very easy to just sign up for Gmail or to just sign up for Amazon or sign up for any of these companies that are providing very good products that you want. But be cognizant that it's worth your while to check out their privacy policies and to go to their page that describes their privacy policy. And if you have an account with them, check your profile settings and indicators around privacy of your information.
True. But with the Internet of Things, you don't associate that your home thermostat is collecting information about you. Because it's convenient. Your home thermostat can be programmed. It can collect information. It learns about your habits.
And it may not be so easy to tell the thermostat to opt out of
other
communications.
Don't pay attention to this. Okay. Or you're playing a game. If you have a game console that either has a camera on it.
Didn't Kinect do something like this?
That's yes. Right. And or a gesture control system on it. Those things learn about you. And that data is stored somewhere. You don't even think of it as being part of your personal private information. But it is. So, okay, you have your Fitbit and you're going to count the number of steps. You're sharing that with other people.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of those things were not built with security in mind.
Right.
So they're easily hacked.
And just recently, there was a huge hack that happened.
Yes.
And it seems like you know a lot about it. Can you explain more?
Well, there's a website run by a man named Krebs, and he comments...
Yeah, it's a great website, folks, by the way.
He comments on security problems in software and comments on other software issues. And someone decided to hack his site by doing a distributed denial of service attack, which means that he enslaved a bunch of other devices to send messages to his server. Yeah. Requesting services.
Yeah, just bombard the server and so it can't actually respond to legitimate traffic.
It was millions of requests. His service provider eventually just shut it off. They said, we can't handle this.
It was the largest attack, too,
yes.
In the history of the Internet.
And for those of you who care, the source code for that particular hack is already out there.
Oh.
The people who created that hack posted the source code. So now anybody can do it. And they actually didn't go through other computers. When we think about other computers becoming zombified and attacking a site, we think of computers, laptops, whatever. This was things, controllers, stuff that we don't think about as being computers that a person controls directly, because these things were connected to the internet and were very easy to zombify because they have no security built in. They're built to connect. They're built to communicate. That's all. That's what they do. And nobody, you know, when these were built, the manufacturers didn't say, oh, someone's going to hack this and use it to launch an attack.
If you had something like a firewall, would a firewall have prevented this? Like, if you didn't want to be part of this problem, if you had a firewall, would that protect it, or is the firewall not enough?
Not necessarily, no. Because a lot of these things, you know, just bypass the firewall. You know, so it became, you know, it's a problem. So it's something that we should all consider, that every device you bring into your house that's connected to the internet is a potential security risk. If you don't care, you don't care.
Well, that's my biggest concern about the Internet of Things is multiplying the possible number of vectors of infection.
Absolutely.
Into my house. Maybe, okay, my firewall blocks an attack, but my thermostat doesn't, and that becomes the weak link, and now my...
Or your garage door opener doesn't.
Correct.
Or your security lights don't.
There's a show that I watch. It's called Mr. Robot.
And yes.
Did you see that episode? There was, on the second season, there's an episode where they hack into a smart home and mess with every single device to the point where she actually had to leave her house because her house became not usable.
Yes, yes. And that's, all of that is now possible. That wasn't science fiction. That was possible. If you can hack into all those systems, you can control those systems. Turn the thermostat down to 45. You can't stay in a house that you can't heat.
Right.
Set the stereo to blast music at the loudest level. Okay. You're sitting there. And turn off the lights.
So right.
You're in the dark and the cold and there's loud things coming at you.
Are they building these devices to work if you're disconnected from the internet, or do some of these things like will not work if they're not connected to the internet?
I would guess that depends on the manufacturer, how they build them, you know. Yeah. But they sell them as smart devices. So they sell them as you connect. That's the big advantage. I mean, we all have locks on our doors. I mean, I don't have a smart thermostat. It's the smartest thing about my thermostat is that I can program it only in my house. It's not connected to the internet. And that's not because I was thinking about this. It was just, well, that's just the way the thermostat is.
Right. And I guess that's another concern, is that if your device, your thing on the internet, that's part of the Internet of Things, requires a back end that's run by a certain company, and then the question is, how much do you trust that company to keep their back end running? So if I buy from company A and it's, say, my stereo, and their back end is required, if they get bought out by company B, company B could come along and say, well, we need to shut down those servers. And now I've got a
it's
stereo.
It's not supported anymore.
It's not supported anymore. It becomes obsolescent in one day. All the components are good. It just, because it relies on a server that's been shut off, it's now a brick, basically.
Right, right. So there, as I said, there are many advantages, and in the medical field, there's huge advantages because, you know, non-invasive kind of monitoring. You know, before, 5 years ago, if you had some sort of chronic illness, and particularly say you had heart disease or something, or fibrillation, every time you felt your heart going wonky, you would rush to the doctor or to an emergency room. Well, as I said, today, implantable defibrillators, and these things take care of themselves, and they communicate with your doctor. Well, that makes someone feel good that they've got that. But at the same time, that means that's information that's flowing through the air. It all works wirelessly. So someone can pick that up. And if someone can pick that up, somebody can tamper with it. So I can, your heart may be running perfectly well, but if I decided I want to kill you, I'm going to turn on the defibrillator.
And hack it, yeah.
That sounds horrible, you know, but it's possible.
I think there's another aspect to Internet of Things that we haven't talked about yet, and that is from an economic standpoint. If you think of the fact that Internet of Things is not just in the consumer world, but also in the commercial world.
Oh, absolutely.
If you look at utilities these days, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise has a suite of services that we call the edge servers because they're on the edge of the Internet. And they are helping to actually drive the operations of utilities and large buildings and other corporations. So they're able to save the labor that used to be necessary to run a generator plant, for example, because they can be controlled from one central location thousands of miles away without having as many people to be there and manually control the physical equipment.
Or even read the meter.
Or even read the meter. The meter is readable remotely. And you don't even have to have a person read it. Have the meter simply log information into the log where the system's keeping track of the readings. So it's not even reading anymore.
Right.
It's not a person reading anymore. So there's a tremendous economic impact to this whole genre of devices that are now buildable. And Kat, you've been working on controllers. I mean, this is absolutely your world with the controllers potentially being connected to the internet and controlling things that used to have to be controlled by people before.
So you didn't know you were part of this new world.
Oh, when I said controllers, I meant like the computer that controls decisions.
Well,
yeah. So well. I get what you're saying. I see the connection. That's really good.
So there's all sorts of implications. You know, when I think of airplanes, for example, part of the gamification thing, I have a friend who has given me access to a large airplane simulator. I mean, this is the thing that's actually used to train pilots. You step into this capsule and the thing behaves like an airplane. You're looking at screens, you're looking at a control panel, just the cockpit of a large airplane. So, okay, it made it into a game. And of course, if you crash the simulator, you didn't die. But that's what they now use to train pilots and train people to fly these large planes. Well, there's all sorts of when you look at a real airplane and you look in the cockpit, there's a lot of computers. It's basically a lot of computers flying together.
And it's flying itself.
They can fly themselves, and it's amazing. Because you think, okay, this airplane is flying by the grace of all these computers that connect all the parts. What if the connections are
to the
broken?
Internet?
Yeah.
Well, what happened to that drone? The Iranians took control of that drone because it was connected to some network.
Yes.
And they took control of it and navigated it back to their base.
So it happened with a drone, which is a fairly simple kind of flying machine. But when you think about today's big airplanes, again, they're all computer controlled.
Right. So. And then what's probably closer to home for most people is cars as well.
Yes, absolutely.
With cars now, it's been established that you can get external control of a car to the extent of putting on brakes,
Or not putting on brakes.
Or disallowing the brakes to be put on, stopping the engine or not stopping the engine.
I hope that they're not making decisions based off of what they send in and out of the internet or through a network connection, because a lot of those things are require quick reaction, and with the internet, there's a lot of latency.
It's not that they're necessarily sending information out over the internet to interact with the car itself, but the cars have the ability now to hook up to the internet, and those hookups are also part of the same system that control the car. So if that then becomes the vector into attacking the car, and then you put on the brake, but I told the car that...
Ignore that.
And now you have no brakes.
So there have been experiments to actually demonstrate the feasibility of doing it. They actually did it. So it's a little scary. The market for old cars may recover. Those that don't have a lot of computers.
And I guess we should say that the situation where it was proved that you could, in fact, hack a car was in a controlled situation.
Yes.
And the manufacturers are doing everything they can to make sure that they're improving the software and the security of the software that's in those cars.
I sure hope
cars
so.
To make sure that doesn't happen with the general public.
And the people that were successful in hacking the car used to work for NASA. So it isn't, you know, the 12-year-old kids. So it was... They hacked a Jeep and made it crash.
And I would expect better security in a product that you're spending lots of money on versus something that you spent $100 on for maybe a potentially small company.
Well, that depends. Again, that depends.
You shake in my faith.
I'm sorry. No, you just have to be aware of it. I mean, you can't go around fearing every piece of technology that there
no,
is.
No, you just have to be aware. But it is somewhat...
disconcerting?
Nah, disconcerting, but also somewhat disappointing that I would have thought that we would have learned this lesson the first time around when the internet became a big thing, that things need to be more secure. And now we've got the internet of things, and in our excitement, we've committed the same sort of mistakes again where we put no security on anything.
Yes.
Well, I think part of that's also just looking at businesses trying to make money, and they're not necessarily looking to spend lots of money for security.
Right.
Right.
So it costs money to make things secure.
Oh, sure does. Sure does.
I think sometimes they may not even realize it, when they're designing this brand new thermostat that can be controlled from the internet. I don't think that they think, oh, some bad guy's going to hack into this thermostat and turn the heat up to 95 in this house or whatever it is.
That's why we need to make sure that all the engineers are IEEE engineers and understand all of the security mechanisms that we try to put into play and teach people as IEEE engineers. And with that...
before we wrap up this topic, Kat, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Thank you so much for giving me lots of information about gamification and the Internet of Things.
Now you'll be careful about what you buy, right?
Yes. I will think twice before I buy that product.
Okay. James, any last thoughts on Internet of Things?
Just be careful. Look at the companies from which you're buying your products and check out their privacy policies and think about security.
I guess it's up to me to leave you with an optimistic view of the world.
Oh, go ahead.
There are a lot of new devices that are taking advantage of the technologies that engineers have developed. Just the fact that these things can be miniaturized and can be used in all kinds of environments, I think, is amazing. I think it's great. Just think of cameras. How big was a camera in the past? And now, just the fact that you can pull your phone out of your pocket and take movies with it. That is just so great. Just the convenience and just the capabilities that we now have are, I think, a testament to people's ingenuity. So don't be afraid of technology, but be careful with it.
Okay. That's a good thought to end with. And again, I just want to remind our listeners, if you've enjoyed what you've heard, you might want to consider becoming an IEEE member. Visit our website at IEEE-NH.org. My name is Ed Nelson. I've been your radio host, and this has been the October edition of Tech IE. Catch you next month. Bye-bye.
Bye.